out in a personal way about the prophet, as you might note in verse 2, for example. That's another one of his personal comments. It's not going to be many days hence when we're going to meet Isaiah, and it would be very nice to think if, through the opportunities of our rather lengthy class together, that we will be able to say to him, we know you. And we might be able to sit in his company again and say, well what did that little passage mean? It was when it said that their strength is to set still, John, we might be able to ask Isaiah just what he did mean by that. And other questions that have come along the way. It would be a sheer delight, wouldn't it, to meet the personage of a man who, in a time of Judah's greatest stress, was the strength in that kingdom, humanly speaking. He wasn't the strength. Yahweh was the strength. But he was the vehicle of that awareness of God, of that spirit and glory of God in that city. And he imbued that to the king, who was of the same mind indeed. And so this little group began to fight the issues of faith within that city. And so they were saved. Yahweh, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. But it wasn't an easy chapter, was it? I'm sure that not one of us would have felt as we ran through the chapter, well, I can see exactly what all of those things mean and how they fit in. It's been quite an interesting chapter, a real challenged chapter to try and sort out. But I think the lines of thought do run out fairly clearly when we give it the time that it should. It starts off with, woe to thee that spoilest and that wast not spoiled. Now you will remember that is in a sequence of woes. If you turn back to chapter 29 verse 1, chapter 28 verse 1, sometimes called the six woes of Isaiah, woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim. So there is a prophecy that is beginning in its description to bring judgment against the northern kingdom and thence in the latter part to Judah. 29 verse 1, woe to Ariel. That undoubtedly is a prophecy against Judah. Chapter 30 we've done fairly recently. Chapter 30 verse 1, woe to the rebellious children, saith Yahweh, that take counsel but not of me, and that cover with a covering but not of my spirit. Same group exactly in chapter 31, verse 1. And so we come now to chapter 33. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled. There's a grand sweep in the chapter. Did you notice that from verse 16 onwards, there was just one picture after another. Beautiful pictures of things dealing with the kingdom. And I might say, as an interesting comment, those pictures are almost unique to Isaiah 33. That makes it a really interesting chapter. You can search around, you might have a snippet here and there. But they're almost unique little pictures that are given in Isaiah 33 about facets of the kingdom. Like verse 17, thine eyes shall see the king and his beauty. They shall behold the land that is very far off. Where do you get comments like that? It's a very grand comment, isn't it? Look upon Zion, verse 20, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation. It's about seeing things with the eye, isn't it? Verse 17, verse 20. But there the glorious Yahweh will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams. Glorious language, exultant language, special and unique language. The inhabitants shall not say, I am sick. The people that dwell therein shall be forgiven their iniquity. So there's an all-encompassing salvation. And with sin taken away, all the good things of reconciliation and salvation have come to the people that have seen the end of this wonderful 33rd chapter. Now, just as a quick review, my responsibility this year in Isaiah is also the 34th and 35th chapters, which are different again. So we'll be dealing with those together. The 33rd is sort of a bit left over from last year, in a sense, in so much that it really belongs with the previous chapters, whereas 34 and 35, in a quite remarkable and interesting way, have a sequential thought running through them. But then in the latter part of the year, Brother John King, is going to take up chapters 36 to 39, which you might remember is the historical section, 36, 37, 38 with the Song of Isaiah, and 39 with the visitors from Babylon. And that's the historical section, put in there in the middle of Isaiah because the chapters that come after that amplify and build upon those pictures with their subsequent prophecies. So we're covering a bit more of Isaiah this year, but Brother John is helping out with that section. What does it mean then, coming back to verse 1, when it says, "Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee." The spoiler, and the one who dealt treacherously, was the invader, the Gentile invader, who rampaged through the land, spoiling, making covenants and breaking covenants, speaking a word and then doing whatever pleased him. And he could do that, as great powers always could do that. No one dares cross them. So they can spoil, but then who is going to pick an argument with them? Or who is going to bring spoiling against them when they, with such power, such devastating power, have brought that spoiling and treacherous dealing against their foes? Men cringe before such behaviour. You know, in more recent times, we have a really remarkable example of that. A lot of people have said, "Well, you know, I can't understand the Jewish people. Why didn't they rise up against Hitler? Why didn't they at least do something to show some resistance?" But my dear brothers and sisters, it's a very, very difficult thing to do that. There's a book called Justice in Jerusalem. You may have heard of it. It's by a man who was a lawyer at the trial of Adolf Eichmann. And he records stories in there as he addresses to the judge information in respect to that question: why didn't the Jewish people rise up and do something? And he gives the example, for example, as not in a Jewish context, but in a Polish context, where because there was a Polish resistance fighter who dared to spoil, he shot a Nazi in the country, he saw the opportunity, so he took his life. But you see, the next afternoon, at 5 o'clock, when everybody was coming out of the offices in Warsaw, in came the troops, and they just cordoned off the whole area. Everybody had to stand still. The streets were full of people, and they just went around and they took that girl at 16. They took that man at 55, father of four children, and they took this man here at 48, and this man over here at 36, and whoever they liked, and put 100 men up there in the streets. And with all eyes upon them, they just mowed them down. See, that's why you cannot spoil the spoiler. He's got power, hasn't he? And Assyria was exactly the same. If there was any sense of retaliation, and many a person in Israel must have felt like it, then in fact you bring down upon your own heads something even far worse. So the spoiler gets away with it. "Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled." Brutal, barbarous force that could do what it liked. And no one dared resist. "Well," says verse 1, "your time is up." You've got away with it, but your time is up. And now it's going to come back upon you. An excellent quotation to give the sense of that is found in chapter 10. Very, very similar thought indeed. Chapter 10 of Isaiah. Again, it's dealing with the Assyrian. "Wherefore it shall come to pass," verse 12, that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, your turn will come. I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he saith, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent. And I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures, and I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And so on. It was all his own prowess, his own skills, his own plotting and planning. God says in verse 24, therefore thus saith the Lord Yahweh of hosts, O my people that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian. He shall smite thee with a rod and shall lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt. For yet a very little while and the indignation shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction. There's a time set for him too. So the spoiler, the one that dealt treacherously, had a time coming to him as well. In the 17th chapter, it speaks about the end coming to the spoiler. He thinks that he's going to get away with it everlastingly, and eventually boasts, of course, in his own prowess. But in chapter 17, verse 14, and behold, at evening tide, in trouble. And behold, the morning, he is not. See, he's gone. He had a grand time before, feasting in all of the luxuries that came to him because of his power and prowess. This is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. So that too is a very relevant passage to what we have. Do you remember the name of Isaiah's second son? Who can remember what that name was? Sorry? That was the first one. Who was the second one? Sorry, Judy. That's right. Mahushalat Hashbaz. She didn't want to say it out really loud, did she? Chapter 8. Verse 1. Mahushalat Hashbaz. It was the second son that was given to him. The first one was Shear Jashub, which means a remnant shall return. Now, this one has a little letter by it, Mahushalat Hashbaz, which says that the Hebrew meaning, it's pretty accurately given, is in making speed to the spoil, he hasteneth the prey. Or make speed to the spoil, hasten the prey. Now, that can be in two senses, can't it? Does Mahushalat Hashbaz, is it a comfort to Israel or is it a warning to Israel? How do you read it? Could be either, couldn't it? Well, undoubtedly, the first application is that it was a warning to Judah. No doubt about that. Judgment is coming. Assyria is on the march. And for all of your iniquity, God will remember your ways. But you see, as we're saying, the clock turns. God says, I will be vindicated in my consumption of Assyria. My pleasure will be realized in the consumption of Assyria, he says in chapter 10. And so, as surely as that judgment came upon Judah, so this secondary judgment would come upon Assyria. So the word, therefore, Mahushalat Hashbaz, has more than one application. And as you can see here in chapter 33, verse 1, the echoes are clear. There's his word written through verse 1. His name, I mean, written through verse 1. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled. When thou shalt cease to spoil... Oh, just a minute, I should explain perhaps what it means by dealest treacherously. To deal treacherously is to make an agreement and break it, isn't it? It says in verse 8, he hath broken the covenant. See? So he made an agreement, but he broke the covenant. And that's what dealing treacherously is. It's been a hallmark of all great nations, unfortunately. Where do you find a nation who said one thing in time of war or invasion and stuck to their course? In chapter 21, you've got the same phrase, but here used again concerning the Medes and Persians. The burden of the desert of the sea, as whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it cometh from the desert, from a terrible land. A grievous vision is declared unto me. The treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously. Different context, different people, Medes and Persians, against the Babylonians. And the spoiler, go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media, all the sighing thereof have I made to cease. Chapter 24, verse 16. In a passage which we came to understand was a reference to the general wickedness and infidelity of the nations, the untruthfulness of nations. Halfway through verse 16, but I said, my leanness, woe unto me, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. You might think that's got to do with business. Well, yes, business, of course, is like that and has been for many years, for centuries of time. But I think in the general context of those other passages, chapter 21 and so on, it's speaking about nations, isn't it, in their dealings with each other, that say with sworn arm that they will do such and such, but when it comes their turn, they take whatever policy line suits their best advantage. Now, that's exactly what Assyria had done. And therefore, chapter 33 is actually speaking in reference to that time. In the Second of Kings, chapter 18, there was an agreement made with Hezekiah, a payoff. But it was only a very short effect. Second of Kings 18, verse 15. This is when Assyria had come into the land and had taken many of the cities of Judah. Things were very, very desperate. We've attempted many times to try and understand the environment of what it must have been like. If we're on a piece of territory that would have been, a little bit bigger than York Peninsula. Not very wide, is it? And you're in one spot of that, towards the north, and that's Jerusalem. And this power is coming down one side and coming up the other. And all the cities he's destroying, just one after the other, plucking them up, destroying one after the other. And you're sitting in that city with your little family. Young parents can feel that issue, can't you? Really feel that issue. What are you going to do with your family? So in the dire extremities, verse 15, Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasure of the king's house. For what is gold against people? No doubt Hezekiah thought. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of Yahweh and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. It didn't stop him. Obviously that was the intention, that was the agreement. But on he came. And that was typical of his ways. He was one who dealt treacherously. He only made agreements so that he might break them. I remember my Latin teacher speaking about ambigeterix, who used to make agreements with the Romans, particularly with Julius Caesar. He was a member of the Germani that were later the Germans. And my Latin teacher was a bit of a character. And he said, you know, ambigeterix, he used to say, because he always made agreements, he was going to do this and that with the Romans, and they'd shake hands, and a group would come from the Romans to sit down with him, and the next minute he'd assassinate them, or he'd make some other agreement, and he'd go around and trick them again. He was just full of tricks, you see. And he said to him, you know, typical of international diplomacy, he said, ambigeterix, he said, he was so crooked, he said, he could sleep comfortably in a corkscrew. I never forget that. Those who went to Unley High School will remember that teacher very much. He was a quite interesting old chap. But typical, you see, dealing treacherously. Make agreement, sign it, you know, ambassadors come and swap this and that, but they don't stick to what they say at all. The opportunity for spoil was so great. Now the second half of verse 1 says, when thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. You see, any great invading power eventually gets to the point where it thinks, well, what am I going to do with all the things that I have got? You've got to be able to realise the prosperity of it, don't you? Sit and enjoy it. You've got to have peace to do that. If you've got a lot of goods, then if you're going to cause that to prosper, you need to have a period of time, peace. And so in a very interesting way, the prophet is perceiving a time when Assyria now just got one city to go. She's cracked 48 of them. Lachish is gone. And there's just Jerusalem to go, and she can go home and her army can say, right, boots up, sword up, now we're going to enjoy the rewards of what we've worked for. And God says, when you think it's time now to deal truly, when you think it's time to forget spoil, you become the spoil and others will deal treacherously with you. You will not be able to realise the benefits of what you have taken from others. It will be Israel's turn then to turn upon you and to deal treacherously with you. So Assyria was not going to realise the fruits of all the spoil that she had taken from others. Now isn't it absolutely beautiful to see verse 2? What a contrast with verse 1. Here's a prophet. They were not automatic people, automatons, were they? They were people like you and I. Isaiah too had his wife, and he had his children. He loved those children like you and I love our children, and we concern ourselves for their future. And he was in that city. When he was speaking to those people, he was in it just with them. He wasn't writing a letter from somewhere a long way away and saying, this is what you ought to do in Jerusalem. He was right in it with them. And in the midst of this verse 1, which seemed to be promising relief, he gives expression to his feelings in all the gravity of this most historic and remarkable time. O Yahweh, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm, that is the faithful remnant. Be thou their arm every morning. Our salvation also in the time of trouble that obviously was getting very close. That's beautiful, isn't it? He's given verse 1. He can see what it means. There's going to be a break in the turn, in the circumstances of the event. God is going to come to his people. He's going to provide them with relief. And the treacherous dealer, the great Assyrian spoiler, was going to come to his grief. O Yahweh, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. See, Isaiah had his own group of disciples. In the 8th chapter, you understand that must have been the circumstance. One of the thrills about Isaiah is to put all these little references together, build up the picture, doesn't it? Just took one of these little pictures, you'd be a bit hesitant to sort of say what you can say when you put the little bits of other passages together. But you see, there was an Isaiah class, so to speak. They got through more chapters than we did. But there was an Isaiah class. See verse 15? Many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. 8 verse 15. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. All right, that's got New Testament echoes, hasn't it? But it's also got relevance to the days when Isaiah was speaking. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait upon Yahweh that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. That's the group who was saying that in verse 2 of chapter 33, isn't it? It wasn't everybody. They weren't all there. like Bible class, I suppose, like our Isaiah class, not all there. But there was some in Judah who could have been there. His house was just down the road. But there was a division. There were those like that, and there were those that were looking at other things. So there was a group of Isaiah-minded people. In the next verse, verse 18, he says, I and the children that thou hast given thee. So his family was there, see? And there were others as well. Bind up the testimony among my disciples. We will wait. So there was this enthusiastic little group within that nation. O Yahweh, be gracious unto us, is the group that is being called upon. Now, in so much that this is a little personal comment of Isaiah, can you remember some of the other little personal comments? Have you got a little list of them? We have made a bit of a list. Can you remember some of them? There's one in chapter 2. A lovely one in chapter 2. Just very quickly, sort of a bit of a diversion, but I just wanted to show you that if you put all these little bits together, as we've mentioned a number of times, it makes a really lovely picture of the prophet. 2 verse 5. Remember that one? He's been given this picture of all nations coming up to Jerusalem in the future when it will be a city of truth as it always should have been. And they're learning of the laws of Yahweh in that place. And he's moved by that. And he said, look, we're sitting in the place now. This is our city. Yahweh's speaking about the place that we live in. Right in the midst of us is this same city. O house of Jacob, verse 5. Come ye and let us walk in the light of Yahweh. If that's going to be so in the future and we're sitting here now, what are we doing about it? That's our hope. He's a tremendous person, wasn't he? There's no question about Isaiah. If you went to his class, my dear brothers and sisters, it would have been electric, wouldn't it? He was a real person, fervently involved with the direction and salvation of his people. Chapter 26, verse 9. Verse 8 and 9. Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. The desire of our soul is to thy name. You know, how many of us could put our hand up and say unequivocally, that is us. The desire of our soul is to thy name. A total capitulation to the interests of God in his life. Here's his prayers, verse 9. With my soul have I desired thee in the night. Yea, with my spirit within me will I seek thee early. What a beautiful person he was. It's no wonder that he was the spiritual leader of that nation. Or now later in the prophecy, chapter 63. You know how that... We often have a little essay in our class. This would make an excellent essay, wouldn't it? Find the little passages of Isaiah in the prophecy of Isaiah and write up a little essay about him. Would that make a good project, Evelyn? Good. I just think it would make an excellent project. So we'll see if we can work on that. 63 verse 17. O Yahweh, why hast thou made us to err from thy ways? And hardened our hearts from thy fear? Is this a sort of independent man that looks at all the sins of his people and says, oh, what a rotten bunch? He's not like that at all, is he? He's involved with them. Look, he's as hot about the things of God as you could ever be. He's as committed, he's as total in his dedication as you could ever be. But he's still touched with his people. And in that is a beautiful balance. We should be totally committed to the interests of God. But with that, my dear princes, no matter how searingly righteous that life might be, we must be involved with our people. It's when that gap broadens and we become very assiduously interested in things of God to all men, but we forget the people we're dealing with, that we get problems, isn't it? But this man's not like that. This man is strong in all matters of truth. An absolutely dedicated man. But he loves God's people. He'll cry for them. He'll plead for them. He'll petition God. As though God did make their hearts as though he did harden their hearts. Return for thy servant's sake, the tribes of thine inheritance. The people of thy holiness have possessed it but a little while. Our adversaries have trodden down thy sanctuary. We are thine. Thou never bearest rule over them. They were not called by thy name. Beautiful man. Chapter 64, verse 9. Be not wroth very sore, O Yahweh. Neither remember iniquity forever. Behold, see, we beseech thee. We are all thy people. That's a lovely man. You can really live with a person like that, can't you? And however righteous he might be, however searingly dedicated, you can go with him because he's got a heart that feels. He's not above his people, even though in life he was so wonderfully dedicated. Chapter 33 again, then. The next phrase that we love in this passage is that he says, we have waited for thee. Can anyone think of some of the other wait passages? We did go through them once before. I'll wait for a little while. Did you make a list of them? I'm sure you would have. They're in chapter 30, or some of them were, and we listed some of them there. Can you remember some of the other wait passages? 25 verse 9. Sorry. In chapter 30, 18, yes. Okay, just put that one then just aside for a moment. 25 verse 9. It should be said in that day, lo, this is our God, we have waited for him. What do we wait for God? What does it mean? Is God behind us? We have waited for him. And he will save us. This is Yahweh, we have waited for him. Chapter 26, verse 8. Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. Chapter 64, verse 4, where we were just recently. For since the beginning of the world, men have not heard nor perceived by the ear, neither hath the eye seen, O God, beside thee, what he hath prepared for him that waiteth for him. Who do you wait for? You wait for someone you believe in, don't you? Like the young man that's sitting there on his special day and she hasn't turned up on time. The clock gets round, 5 past, 10 past. You'll still wait there. I've never seen them go home. Until eventually she does turn up, even if it's the car's fault or the dress wasn't right or whatever it was. He'll still wait, won't he? Why? Because he believes in her. And that's why we wait for somebody, isn't it? We'll wait because we believe in that person. We know that something has gone wrong, or they would have come, and they will turn up. We have trust in that person. O Yahweh, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. It's just another way of practically speaking about faith. The person who waits is a person who has faith in Yahweh. And my dear brothers and sisters, those words today are remarkably relevant, aren't they? The need to hold on and not to swing around in a world that is quickly reassessing all values. All values. Did you see the groping that was in the paper? Was it yesterday? And the letters to the editor? Did you see all those letters that came in? People groping, aren't they? For values, because the education department has made some statement that they're going to include values in their teaching. What values, says one man. Is this going to be just a great big compromise? Where do values come from, he says. Values come from God. If they're not Christian values, what values are they? So says one man. So says another man. So on says another man. Got to be God's values, says another man. Can you imagine our society taking God's back? What are values? Toss a coin, can't you? In today's society, you'd have just a complete cross-section of thought on that. You'd have a war on your hands because values are gone. And in that, that's the world we're in. And it isn't easy to keep our values. Values in our work ethic, our integrity and honesty. At work. Our integrity about how we speak to people, about making arrangements in business and our daily employment. Is it right to cheat or to be honest or to sell a foul product? Is that okay now? Because everybody does it now. It isn't, wasn't ever okay, and never will be okay. And so we've got to be very careful that we do really wait for God, and we're the same people that our grandparents were and that our fathers were. That they had that tremendous stability. They were true people, sincere in their conviction about those principles. And that's what Isaiah was like. People were running around in all sorts of directions. Down to Egypt, trying to make a league with the Assyrians, doing all sorts of things. Running hither and thither. But the faithful came into that city and waited for God. What a thing to do. And he says, we have waited for thee. And they came into that city and they went to Isaiah's class, no doubt. Sat down with a prophet and began to enjoy the spirit of faith that was in that class, whereby that people were prepared to set their course in the right way, never mind what might happen around them. And my word, we feel like that today, don't we? If ever you were to assess things from a human standpoint, you'd never be a Christadelphian today, would you? That community finished. They're just completely out of focus with the rest of society. With the society bolting down in this direction, they're going in that direction. You'd never be a Christadelphian today. So it's a great challenge to us, isn't it? Tremendous challenge. We used to have some people at least agree with us in a lot of principles of life. No, they'd sooner have a sodomite than have a Christadelphian. They'd sooner have a man who believed that two women could live together and have children than they would in the principles of God. So he says, be thou their arm every morning. You see, every morning there was bad news arriving. There was reports of the invasion of Sennacherib and his army. Take, for example, chapter 28. Chapter 28 and verse 19. From the time that it goeth forth, this is the judgment, the flood of Assyria, from the time that it goeth forth, it shall take you, for morning by morning shall it pass over. Pass through, says the RSV. Important difference, not pass over, but pass through. It's the flood of the Assyrian, which is referred in this chapter, by day and by night. And it shall be a vexation only to understand the report. Every report you get is bad. Just continuous advance all the time. Like people listened to the radio in 1939 and Hitler was just going, wasn't he, from one city to another, from one province to another, from one country to another. The whole of the low countries just swept by him. That's how it felt to be endured at that time. Syria just swept them all out of the way. It was fearful to get the report. Morning by morning shall it be. Be thou their arm every morning. When they got the daily news, as it were, be thou their arm. What a wonderful thing that is, my dear friends. See the practical nature of this man's mind? He was in it, wasn't he? He was right in the thick of it. He was fighting that issue of faith, just exactly like we are. How do we get up each morning? Ready to fight that battle? Is it in our mind to fight that battle? To maintain the cause of the people of God? In Lamentations chapter 3, Jeremiah, not in the time of Assyrian invasion, but that of Babylonian invasion, he writes up his experience later. Some of the most beautiful words in Scripture. Lamentations 3, verse 22, be thou their arm every morning. This is what he said after all that he went through. Incredible words. It is of Yahweh's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. Would that have seemed like that? In the midst of 19 years of precarious living as the Babylonians came three or four times during that period of 19 years? New every morning are thy mercies. Who could see that? Could you really see that and believe that? New every morning are thy mercies. What a wonderful thing that was. Yahweh is thy portion, my soul, therefore will I hope in him. Yahweh is good unto them that wait for him. To the soul that seeketh him. And that's what we've got to remember. No change of life, my dear brothers and sisters. No fitting in with the world in which we live. No changing of our attitudes to this, that and the other, because that's what the world thinks today. But coming up every morning with our minds upon the things of God and endeavouring to bring cheer and faith and vigour of service into our life. We have waited for thee, be thou their arm every morning. You think Sister Glenys can think like that at the moment? Sister Glenys Mansfield? New every morning are thy mercies? Why should such a thing come upon our shores, my dear brothers and sisters, just when surely we had enough things to handle with the adversity of godliness in this age? But it's still true, isn't it? It is still true, and she's fighting that faith. She's not resenting. She is looking forward to the things that are coming, and we can share that with her. We could leave her out in the cold if we didn't think about it, but she's our sister. She was a sister here, one of our original ones in Brighton. Brought her family up in this meeting. So it's our concern, isn't it? Very much our concern. One of our beloved sisters here in times past, a young mother, grew up through many vicissitudes. She's not letting go, is she? In that, you see, is our help. If she, in those circumstances, having had all these great tubes poked in her body 8 times till she's just treated like a piece of meat, if she can still retain her faith in that, my dear brothers and sisters, then woe betide us if we worry about a hot day or something. There is still plenty of opportunity, isn't there, for us to use the opportunities that are there and to maintain faith. Be thou their arm every morning. More than that, our salvation also in the time of trouble. Yes, he can be redeemed from all circumstances, and he was absolutely the Redeemer in the time of trouble. Chapter 37. Our salvation also in the time of trouble. Then the angel of Yahweh went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. When they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. Now in the following 2 verses, it describes again the destruction of the Assyrians. At the noise of the tumult, the people fled. So verse 2 is like a little personal inflection of the prophet popped into the record. Verse 1 was the warning of that divine judgment that was coming upon Assyria. Verses 3 and 4 continue the story of that divine judgment. And it says, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. That the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. As the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. What does all that mean? Can you unravel that, my dear brothers and sisters? There's a mixture, incidentally, of tenses in this verse. You know, it's very unwise to say that the Hebrew is a future tense, therefore it's future, or the Hebrew is a past tense, therefore it's something in the past. It's not like that. The record is just simply not like that. The tenses are used very much more freely than that. Sometimes for effect, describing things as though they're in the past that are yet indeed to happen in the future. So, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. This is a picture that is seen. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And the fact that it speaks about the tumult at the time of the Assyrian destruction, when he came around Jerusalem and invested that city, reminds us that we've already had that language in chapter 29. or perhaps to save a little time, we'll go straight to chapter 30, because you'll remember it better there, I'm sure. Chapter 30, verse 27, "Behold, the name of Yahweh cometh from far, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, his tongue is a devouring fire, and his breath is an overflowing stream shall reach to the midst of his neck." And chapter 30, verse 30, "Yahweh shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lightning down of his arm. With the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones." So with verses 27, 28 and 30 put together, you have a description of sort of a great storm that has come over that land. It says that the angel of Yahweh went forth and destroyed the host. But those passages are colouring in that day. And how God did do that, how the angel did that, was very interesting to think about, isn't it? Did he come as in the Passover and just quietly put the stroke of death upon them? Or do those passages, as I think they do, imply that there was in fact some physical turbulence in the heavens above? A tumult, verse 3. At the noise of the tumult, verse 3, the people fled. There was something that absolutely scattered the Assyrians. Just breathed fear into them. The same phrase is used in a context we know well, 1 Kings 18:41. "And Elijah said unto Ahab, get thee up, eat and drink, for there is a sound of abundance of rain." That was the storm that was coming in from the Mediterranean, wasn't it? Over Carmel. And so it could well be that something like that came that day and devastated the ranks of the Assyrians. The word nations, of course, is the word for nations. Goyim, G-O-Y-I-M. Jews today still refer to the Gentiles as the Goyim. That is their term. Sometimes out of the side of their mouth, depending on the company you're in. But that is how they speak of the Gentiles, and that is the word there. It says that Yahweh is to lift himself up. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And that's surely with an echo towards the words of Moses in Numbers chapter 10. Numbers chapter 10 and verse 35. Keeping our hands in both passages if you can. "Rise up, Yahweh, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee." Now that's when the ark was set forward. And so there's a sense in verse 3 that the glory of God, the Shekinah glory of God, is now going to go forth and work its work as promised by Moses so long ago. In this occasion, now again, it will do its work against this time the Assyrian. The same phrase, just to show you that it is used elsewhere, borrowed again, of course, from Moses, is in Psalm 68. The opening verse of Psalm 68, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered, let them also that hate him flee before him." So this picture of divine manifestation and glory is portrayed with these little echoes going back to the psalm and then back to Moses as well. Now verse 4 is an interesting verse. It's really intriguing. It almost puts you off the track, doesn't it? What do you make of verse 4? Who's it referring to? "And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar." Now that shows the continuity with verse 1, doesn't it? We said that verse 1 said, "Your turn is come, Assyria. You spoiled, now you're going to be spoiled." Here is his spoil being taken in verse 4. "Your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar." When does the caterpillar say, "I've had enough"? He doesn't, does he? He just goes on eating and eating and eating. And so also does the locust in verse 4. They completely strip a whole area. There's no limit to their appetite. And that's the point that is being made in verse 4. There will be no limit in what the people will take from you. But where did the people leave their spoil? In real terms, where did they leave it? They left it in the camp, didn't they? There was the camp of the Assyrians all around the city of Jerusalem. It must have been an enormous camp. Have you ever stopped to think what it must have been like? 185,000 mature men were being fed out of that. That is a lot of people, isn't it? Probably as many people, or more perhaps, than were in the city itself. What kind of a camp was it? What tremendous supplies of weapons and horses and all kinds of things, armoury. What about food? There'd be mountains of food there, wouldn't there? Absolutely mountains of it. That's the spoil, verse 4, that has been taken. And you can see how it would have happened. When that host was destroyed, people would look over the wall and they'd say, the Assyrians are a bit late up this morning. Until eventually they'd say, they must be pretty smug. Until eventually by 10 o'clock they'd be thinking, are they really there? Where are they? Their tents are devastated. Until eventually somebody would venture to go out, surely, from the city and begin to see what had happened. And it's just completely sprayed with dead people. Everywhere. Hundreds, thousands of them. What do you think the people in Jerusalem did? Those men's booties, their booty bags, as it were just laden with all the riches that they'd plundered from all the surrounding countries, including Judah, weren't they? What would you do? Sit still? You'd go straight into that camp, wouldn't you? And so the inhabitants of Jerusalem would have plundered the things that had been plundered from them. The spoil that they'd taken from all of Judah, lo and behold, it was left to the remnant. The unfaithful that were out there and wouldn't come into that city, saying, no, we'll stay on our own parcel land, thanks. We think we'll be all right out here. One by one, they were clipped off. But they came, the remnant came into that city, and lo and behold, all of the goodness of that land was left to them. Your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. They'll leave nothing behind. I mean, how many times would you go out there? Come in with your hands full? Flour or butter or milk or whatever, and then you go back again, wouldn't you? And you send the family out as well, right? And there's just been nothing left out there eventually. Who would leave anything out there? And so I think that's what verse 4 is speaking about. Now that's interesting because, do you remember, well you do remember I'm sure, Joel chapter 1, very quick. Joel chapter 1 described the invasion of the Assyrians in exactly the terms of a caterpillar and a locust. So this is a playback, see? As we had a playback, as it were, in verse 1, the spoiler being spoiled, so now we have a playback in the terms of Joel. In Joel chapter 1, verse 4 and 5, it says, tell ye your children of it, verse 3, and let your children tell theirs, and their children another generation, that which the palmer worm hath left hath the locust eaten, and that which the locust hath left hath the cankerworm eaten, and that which the cankerworm eateth, cankerworm hath left, hath the caterpillar eaten. It was a doleful judgment that there would be not a thing left. And that's how it was. Isaiah had asked God in chapter 6, how long will this go on? And God said to him, until the cities of Judah be wasted. Isaiah chapter 6, I think verse 8. And that's exactly what happened. They just kept on gnawing and gnawing until eventually the last caterpillar had the last bill. And he brought all that booty up to the city of Jerusalem, and lo and behold, one night he lost the lot. And the caterpillars then turned to be the faithful, who went out into that camp and took every goodness out of it. And so that city was, in a short time, filled with good things. That scenario is based on 2 Kings chapter 7, or my concept of it is. Because in 2 Kings chapter 7, that's exactly what happened, but to a different city and a different invading force. 2 Kings 7, remember this chapter? Where the old lepers came into the camp of the Syrians when God had caused them to flee. 2 Kings 7. and a measure of fine flour would be sold for a shekel and 2 measures of barley for a shekel. Elisha said that and they laughed him to scorn. They'd be easy prices. They were in the midst of a siege. There wasn't a thing to live on. A bare bone was a wonderful meal. And yet suddenly Elijah says, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel and 2 measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. And they laughed him to scorn. Don't be ridiculous. But of course what happened was that the Syrians were frightened by the host of God. They fled their camp, this vast camp, and it was a time of tremendous famine, and the king said, oh, goodness, they've gone. So he put a man on the gate, you remember? And that man on the gate was going to keep some restraint on it. And the men just swept over him, didn't they? The man that leaned on the king at supper. And so they went out into the host of the Syrians and they took everything that they could find in that city. In verse 17. And the king appointed the Lord on whose hand he leaned to have the charge of the gate. And the people trode upon him in the gate, and he died as the man of God had said, who spake when the king came down to him. And so the people completely took the goods and food and so on that was available in the vast camp of the Assyrians. 2 Kings 7 verse 8 and 15 and 16. So verse 4 then does fit the scenario of circumstances that we've got in our historical section. As the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. And I see in that picture, because locusts don't actually run, do they? They hop, and they don't run to and fro. They just sort of hop haphazardly here and there. But I'm sure what's being indicated is that people just kept on going until there was nothing left. And so all the vast spoil of the Assyrian was brought into the city to the joy of the faithful remnant. You happy with that? It's quite an interesting concept, isn't it? But it's just one of those little areas of Isaiah that until you really think about it, it is a problem to work out what it just might mean. If you turn over to verse 23, you'll see that even the lame man enjoyed the spoil. Thy tacklings are loose, they could not well strengthen their mast, they could not spread the sail. Then is the prey of a great spoil divided. The lame take the prey. There was even sufficient for the chap that couldn't get his leg going to get out there. Others came and said, look, you have some. Plenty over, see? Even the lame take the prey. So there was this historic power of Assyria, known for its viciousness. And now even the lame had taken its spoil and its prey. Now, in the greater context, my dear brothers and sisters, the Assyrian goes on to the great northern power of the latter days, doesn't it? To the latter day Assyrian. And in chapter 39 of Ezekiel, we have the parallel thought there as we look forward to exactly the same thing. Christadelphians crazy? Christadelphians extremists? Those who hold the principles of God and believe in the prophecies in the Bible? A bit crazy? Hold on, my dear brothers and sisters. In the way of thy judgments have we thought upon his name. Ezekiel chapter 39, verse 17. And thou, son of man, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, speak unto every feathered fowl and to every beast of the field. Assemble yourselves and come. This is after the destruction of the latter-day Assyrian. What is prepared? A great feast of bounty. Not perhaps literal food, my dear brothers and sisters, but eternal life and all the satisfaction that could ever come from that. Assemble yourselves and come. Gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice that I do sacrifice for you. Even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that ye may eat flesh and drink blood. Ye shall eat the flesh of the mighty and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams, of lambs, of goats, of bullocks, all of them fatlings of Bashan, the strongest, most powerful people in the world. And ye shall eat fat till ye be full and drink blood till ye be drunken of my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed for you. My dear brothers and sisters, as the Apostle Paul said, all things are yours. All things are for you, he says also in Corinthians. hold on. Let's keep our direction clear and our way of life consistent. Now in verses 5 to 6 we have an absolutely delightful picture. It says there, when all this has happened, you see it, the picture flashes by, and now we've come through to the end of Assyria. We'll come back there again, but now in verses 5 to 6, this is the aftermath. As it's the kingdom, the aftermath of the latter day Assyrian's destruction. Yahweh is exalted. Wasn't Hezekiah was king? Yes, he was sick. Sick nigh unto death in the very vortex of all these things. Yahweh is exalted. Yahweh's strength was made perfect in Hezekiah's weakness. When the king could do nothing but plead to God for life, that city was delivered. So it was truly Yahweh who was exalted, for he dwelleth on high. That city was greatly magnified. And Yahweh was obviously its king. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. Now that's a glorious picture, isn't it? It goes past the invasion of the Assyrian and goes on, straight on to the coming kingdom of God. You see, it's Yahweh exalted because it was Yahweh's people, Yahweh's city, Yahweh's law that they were standing for. Yahweh's deliverance, Yahweh's power that brought that death upon the Assyrians, as it will be in the future. And that's the fruit of the great events that have taken place. So he is exalted. He dwelleth on high. The faithless seem to have the most. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. All right, what's the connection there? Judgment and righteousness? That's chapter 32, isn't it? Verse 1. Clear as a bell. Remember how we had the two words ringing last time. A king shall reign in righteousness. Princes shall rule in judgment. It's an echo straight back to 32 verse 1. Verse 16. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. Verse 17. The work of righteousness shall be peace. And the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. It's in line with those passages beautifully. Picking up that theme, this is the new administration. In the aftermath of Assyria's destruction, a people came to take the reins of government. There was Eliakim. Shebna was gone. You know how it says Yahweh is exalted, he dwelleth on high? Do you remember what it said of Shebna? Chapter 22. Shebna was not a faithful man. Shebna thought that he cut himself out an eternal place in the temple. He was over the house, verse 15, chapter 22. What hast thou here, Shebna? And whom hast thou here? That thou hewest thee out of sepulchre here, as he that heweth him out of sepulchre on high. See? Shebna thought he'd make himself a personal position. It's Yahweh that is exalted. He is dwelling on high. Not Shebna itching himself out a little dwelling place on high, as though he'd make himself a great name. Behold, Yahweh will carry thee away with a mighty captivity. And his name means to lead captive. And will surely cover thee. See, that administration's gone. The Shebnas are finished. It's the Eliakims that are spoken of in verse 20. It shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with thy robe and strengthen him with thy girdle. Commit thy government into his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. That's a change of administration. From the Shebnas to the Eliakims, they're standing as token men. And that was a promise there that that would happen. And here in chapter 33 is when it's going to happen, says God. I will fill Zion with judgment and righteousness. There won't be any people in here who don't agree with these principles. No split city anymore. They're all in Isaiah's class, so to speak. Because they've seen the manifestation of the glory of what God has done. So the new administration of chapter 32, which of course was only a type of greater things to come, my dear brothers and sisters, is here portrayed beautifully. And what's the theme of their administration? Verse 6. You read any more beautiful words than this? And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times, and strength of salvation. The fear of Yahweh is his treasure. Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. There's an echo again, isn't it? Wisdom and knowledge. Chapter 11. Isaiah's famous prophecy of a righteous ruler whose mind would be full of wisdom and understanding. This unique passage where seven times it is spoken of as the Spirit of Yahweh coming upon this particular, the son of Jesse. Isaiah 11 and verse 2, and the Spirit of Yahweh shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of Yahweh, making him of quick understanding in the fear of Yahweh. It's that person now in chapter 33 that is governing these affairs, and that wisdom and knowledge is the stability of his times. What beautiful words they are in the world in which we live, my dear and sisters, with the old ships just wandering around on the oceans without any course whatsoever. There's no oar in the ocean. There's no rudder to give any direction whatsoever. Would know where she's going. Where is any country going? Tell me that. There's not one of them have a policy. The only person I believe really has a policy today is the Pope. He's got a policy. His policy is to bind up Europe in Catholicism again. He's got a vision, at least of that, as crooked as it might be. That's his kingdom. But where is the people today that have got wisdom and knowledge to give direction to people? This will be the stability of his times. You know, people love to have stability, don't they? If there could be a man in Australia who could stand up and say, this is where we're going. Give a picture. Could paint a picture that was both righteous and decent and honourable. People would go with it, I believe. There's not a soul in the land, in this country or in any other country. Money. It's about the only thing they're interested in. It's the only thing that they can move politics with. Money and personal advantage. Well, in that day, wisdom and knowledge, forgotten in our society. Do you ever hear anybody speak about wisdom as a credential for a politician? Wisdom and strength of salvation. Did you notice that salvation is in the plural? Because there's many people involved in this. Strength of salvations. Many individual people, the saints, will all be enjoying that strength of salvations. To all the individuals that enjoy that. Strength of salvations. Why? Because it's immortal life. You can't take it away from them anymore. They were despised in their own day, but now they are vindicated once and forever. And that's where we're going. If we're true to our calling, my dear princes, that's where we're going. It doesn't matter what the world thinks of it. We have got the wisdom and knowledge that God has given us in his wonderful blessing through the Word. Without that, we wouldn't have it. We've got to cling on, hold hard to that and keep it with us in our daily life. And the final phrase is, the fear of Yahweh is his treasure. I wrestled over that. What do you make of that? It's not an easy phrase, is it? Well, the people, I suppose, recently, as it were in verse 4, had run out of the city and they found a treasure, didn't they? Found spoil and prey. What did God get out of that? Does he need flour? Does he need meat? Does he need cheese? Does he need armour? Does he need swords? Does he need gold? Does he need jewels? Does he need any of that plunder? What did he get out of that? What was his treasure? The fear of Yahweh is his treasure. His name was vindicated. Do you remember the last verse of Ezekiel 38? Thus will I be magnified in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. That's what he gets out of it. You can't give him anything else. But he did create the world and he created man, and the thing that should surely come home to him is respect and admiration for all that he has done. And that's what will happen. As it happened in the days of Hezekiah. Just our final reference, 2nd of Chronicles. 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 30. Chapter 32. And Yahweh saved Hezekiah. Chapter 32, verse 22. He saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and with the hand of all other, and guided them on every side. What a beautiful expression. God was in that city. How did that happen? Did it mean that God was, say, what the angels was guiding them physically? Through Isaiah? Yes. Through angels? Yes. He was in that city. He had seen what he'd wrought, and he was in that city, and he filled it with good people whose minds were of knowledge and wisdom. They loved it. They loved the things of God. Like our ecclesia, my dear, it's going to be a place where people love wisdom and knowledge. Where we read books about the things of God and study our Bibles and turn up to our Bible class and take an interest in our Sunday school and back the work of ecclesial life through 1997. Never mind what the world thinks of us, we're here because we've got a commitment. He guided them on every side. Any less a God today than then? No. He will be in this hall, he'll be with us in our lives. He'll be with Sister Glenys. He'll be with the Southern Vales meeting. He'll see them through all of those problems. We'll be better for what we may experience in it ourselves. What does Glenys pay the price for all of us? It may well be that it pulls us up, as that's what's happened before, isn't it? We lost Phil King. In the next few months, there were dozens of young people lining up to get through the waters of baptism. We never lose if we wait for God. And that's what happened here. They waited and he guided them on every side. Imagine what it was like in that city. Many around the world, they brought gifts unto Yahweh to Jerusalem and presents to Hezekiah, king of Judah. They brought gifts unto Yahweh. The fear of Yahweh is his treasure. And that spread around the world, and they brought gifts, not that he needed those gifts. But the fear of Yahweh was his treasure. And it meant that the world had come to recognize that the God of Israel lives. As he does tonight, my dear brothers and sisters. And as we go through our Isaiah study this year, may it be a cause of great rejoicing to us, strengthening our heart, strengthening our faith in him. Thank you.